Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode.
Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. Today, Sean and I are joined by Robin Hadley. Robin is an independent researcher, consultant, lecturer, author, and speaker whose own life experience has led him to be a leading expert on the psychological and sociological impacts of male childlessness. Robin is a founding member of the campaign group Aging Without Children, and in 2015 completed a PhD with the thesis title Life Without Fatherhood, a qualitative study of older involuntary childless men. This is the Male Fertility Podcast. Welcome to episode 8, Childlessness with Robin Hadley.
Robin, hello.
Hi, thanks for the invite.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you for joining us. It's like a real honour. And like I said to you, like once I started preparing for the episode and looking at what we were going to cover, wow, this is going to be such a vitally important topic. It's a big one. It really is. And it's something that certainly we've all found ourselves in this situation. And let's get into it without further ado, really, and discover what it is. Firstly, I suppose if you could give us a broad outline of what it is you do and why.
What do I do? My real interest is in involuntary male childlessness across the life course. So childless men, what happens to them, how they're treated, how they become childless, because quite often it's the assumption is it's infertility. But there's a whole range of things that impact on your reproductive outcomes and your desires. And it goes all over the place. And quite a lot of it is invisible, particularly for men. There's a lot more narratives and stories and press around women. For example, frozen eggs at the moment is a really big thing. The sperm side of things, there's a little bit about it, but not as much. But also there's so much more around the women's journey as a personal thing and not so much around men's personal journeys. So you guys have been out there and doing stuff. And part of that is because there was nothing there for you to draw on. So yeah. Equivalent to your partners who probably had almost too much to draw on.
Yeah, nothing for us at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And why I got into this, whether you want to know this or not, is so I'm 64. I know I don't look it. It's a Manchester rain, you know, all that sort of thing. I should bottle it and sell it and all that sort of thing.
But, you get plenty of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I was I'm a working class lad from Manchester, come from a big family, always expected to be a dad, just thought it would happen. Like almost 99% of men and people think they're fertile and everything's going to be okay. And and a lot of the guys I've interviewed all have the same sort of arc of life. They're going to leave school if they're working class, get a job, find a partner, get married, and have kids. And that's the arc of life. And I guess nowadays also the arc now goes to become grandparents as well. If you're middle class, it was leave school, go to university, find a partner, generational difference now, because quite a lot of younger people go to university. So that's a big thing that comes through. And it just never happened for me, because of a couple of things. Partner choice was a thing. Relationships ending, gap between relationship and partner choice again with my current wife. So not biological infertility. I've never had an infertility test. I've never done a fertility test or anything like that. But I'm involuntary childless, or I'm childless by circumstance. You've got to be careful about the words, because people describe themselves differently at different times of their lives. So now I'm 64, I could sometimes call myself mediated childless, you know, because I didn't choose to be childless. But the situation I'm in, and with my age, I'm not going to become a biological parent or a parent, I don't think, or a, definitely not a biological grandparent. And yeah, in when I was working at the university, I was a scientific and technical photographer. And in the late 90s, digital started coming through and I was doing wet stuff. And it was obviously we were going to get ended. So I started training as a counsellor. And I came out of school with so very few qualifications and no confidence about doing exams or anything like that. And the great thing about counselling is you could do it in small little blocks and build it up. And I started each block thinking, well, I'll do this. It's not too much commitment financially, which was a thing. And I'll fail because that's what I'm used to do with exams. And that'll be fine. That's my expectations and I'll fulfill it, except I haven't fulfilled it. And then I did counselling. I did the counselling, got my postgraduate diploma, and then did an MA. And because it was an MA in counselling, it had to be something you experience. I was in my mid-40s at this time, and I was really broody in my 30s, terribly broody. And all my mates seemed to be having kids, whether they wanted them or not, and I wasn't. But I couldn't express it. It was like a dark cloud over me, but it was like a dark cloud in me. A dark cloud of concrete, actually, because it's like a weight inside me. And I couldn't express it. Like, I can express it now, but I'd be through a lot. So that's it. But at the time in my 30s, I couldn't. And being out of sync. So in the arc of life, the ideal arc would be me at 35, being in a relationship and having kids and being a dad, like all my peers. But I wasn't. I was below that. And I couldn't see a way of achieving it. And sort of socially, you become a parent and your social world change, your social narratives change. The things you... So Minions means nothing to me. But for parents now, it would mean quite a lot, I think. I know I'm sort of out. I'm not in touch with that sort of thing. But the same was then. The parents sort of stuck together in work. I remember... So this is in the mid-90s. So Nintendo DS had just come out. A couple of my colleagues were talking about their kids who must have been 6 or 7, saying, oh, they're on DS. And all I could think of was Drug Squad. And so I said to them, your kids are playing Drug Squad at like that age? You know, it's a bit mad, isn't it? And they just ripped me, took the piss out of me terribly for not knowing that. Well, that's sort of an indication of a separation, of not being part of things in that element. And so, I did my MA dissertation on broodiness because I felt really broody. My supervisor had never done anything about that, about broody men. And that's when I found there was really nothing around men. And the desire for fatherhood, a lot around women, the desire for motherhood, and that's internal, but also political and structural as well. Women can feel forced to go down that road, whether they want to or not, because the social dynamic is all around that. But for men, there's this assumption that, A, you're fertile from puberty until death. Not only you're fertile, you're fully fertile. And it's a complete myth. And also that men aren't bothered about becoming a dad because one of a reinforcing argument there is because you're fertile or for your whole life, you can become a dad at any time. Now we know. And a lot of people listening to this podcast will know that's a load of bull. But there's still an awful lot out there that's still repeated in the general media, that's reinforced in the right on places, that actually, you know, men, not that bothered. Keep them away from it. This is for women and for women only. And men don't do it. So my my friend up in the Lake District, he's a stay-at-home dad and has been since the kids were very small. And when I was doing this research, he said, the amount of discrimination I get at the school gate because the mothers don't think a dad should be there doing that. So that's a sort of marker of the difference within society and in quite a forward society. And then after finding out the MA that these 10 guys I interviewed, such a loss, such a sense of bereavement. And also, I've never spoken to anyone about this. You're the first one I've spoken to around it. And the other thing they all said was, there's something missing. And that's a really important little phrase because it really reflects there's something missing inside, but actually there's something missing in society because there's no narratives for us to occupy. There's no convenient stories. You guys are doing this to put a narrative out there so people can bounce off them. And what I would say, and that's why I did my work as well, that actually after that MA, I thought, this is a story that needs to be told. And what I'd expect is that for men not to just fall in, oh, yeah, that's my experience, but actually say, no, that's not my experience. My experience is this. But by putting that wall of narrative they can bounce off, they actually develop a narrative. So instead of saying there's something missing, they fill in the missing bit themselves by saying, that's not my experience. My experience is this. And quite a lot in counselling, what you hear around mental health is just talk for men. Just talk. But actually, it's listening. It's being listened to and being safe to be listened to. And that's what men really need. Their fear is being humiliated is the really big thing. And that's, I'm getting all this out there. You guys aren't asking questions. So I'm just going to keep going. The fear of humiliation comes in from very early age. If you look at Facebook, I know that's a bit old hat for you young guys with your ticky-tockies and all that sort of thing. But if you look at Facebook and look at when a child is first called my little soldier, my little man, can be when they're 6 months, 8 months, very, very early. And what does that say? That's built in then into that child's environment of being detached from their feelings. If you look at the same age for a girl, my little princess, not my little woman. And what you'll find is older women will say, you know, now I'm 50, I run a multinational company, and my dad still calls me his little princess. But so that there's an issue around that. But for men and boys, that early years environment gets embedded as an internal framework. And part of that becoming my little man is don't be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you know we are born, most of us. bit of a radical medical thing there, so it could stop the presses. boys and girls with the same emotional capacity. I think we can say that. So what happens in society as we grow that boys and men then get detached so that all this stuff happens inside, but there's like a concrete social block put across your shoulders, under your neck, that you find it difficult to express.
Mm.
That's not put in generally, because we're talking big picture stuff here, for girls and women. And it can be sometimes for women will say, actually, you know, I don't actually want to emote all the time, but I'm expected to do it. And so one of the things from that is men express themselves through actions, things outside themselves, but also society conditions them to be outside themselves, to go and bring home the bacon, to go and do that and be outside yourself. And then emotionally, you sort of say, keep it all in. And it's fine when everything's steady, but when pressures get put in intense pressure, like going through infertility treatment. You're trying to achieve that ideal arc and you can't, and you just see it slipping away. And the measures society says, this is how you're measured as a man, through your virility biologically, your virility social economically, and your virility socially, as in sort of friendships. And you're going, well, I'm not like when I was 35, I'm not there, and I can't see myself getting there. And then something else happens, maybe you lose your job, and all these impacts on your virility make you really look at yourself and not know what to do. And part of that is not knowing how to express it, because all your expression is outside yourself by going and getting objects. And part of the thing about counselling that's come through is men really respond to poetry, art, doing things. And there's a guy called Glenn Poole. He wrote a book on male suicide. He worked in, he's in Australia now, but he used to work in the south of England. And what he trained as a counsellor and found out the ways to deal with men and suicide weren't actually working for men, because it's very much worked on based on your feelings from the inside, the very thing you've been conditioned not to go into. That's the number one. And he said, well, it's better to work from the outside. So what's your problem? What can we do right now? It's my job. I want to. And so, okay, let's work on that. And then work from the outside in rather than from the inside out.
Yeah.
How's that, lads? God.
Yeah, kind of an intro.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking, I've got to unpick this.
Yeah. No, honestly, I've written down so many notes that I wanted just from that. And, you know, I really resonated with so much of that. It's those societal norms that are instilled in us from the outset, boys don't cry, etc. And that's what then puts us in holes when something does come up, like it did for us. And Kieran and I have talked about how we experienced that at length, and we were deep in that hole, and it's because we didn't feel like we could emote and express how hurt we were. And it's because it's an intangible loss as well, your fertility. It's that, like you said, from the guys that you interviewed for your MA, it's that bereavement. But yeah, you're not bereaving, like, if, for example, that's often associated with losing a loved one, but you have years of memories, you have photos, videos to grieve. When it's a picture, an ideal, it's really hard to quantify how you deal with that loss. And that's exactly where we both found ourselves.
And that's called disenfranchised grief. Sorry, I thought. And what it means is, because quite a lot of bereavement in societies is structured. So you've lost a partner or you've lost someone, and depending on the society, it can be, right, you're going to grieve like this for so many days. This is going to happen. This is good. So there's a whole structure around it and how to appear and what to do. But when it comes to things like miscarriage, baby loss, society really struggles with that. Many societies really, really do. And that's another form of disenfranchised grief. Disenfranchised, there's no support. There's nothing there within society. And also what can happen is, because that's not there, you then get sort of picked on because you're not fulfilling a societal normal criteria. So that can be involve rage. And for men, when it comes to miscarriage, there's very little around men. There's some coming out through now. But actually, a lot of it was, well, you're a man, just go and deal with it.
Yeah. You know that when you said about the dark cloud feeling, like, that resonates so, so much. And I know that so many people listening to this podcast will feel that like you can't, unless you've experienced it, you can't explain it. It just sits here, sits in your soul, and it just sits there and it doesn't go anywhere. I found what you said really interesting about society norms. Like, is there a certain level of, as you said, we're all born, and from that young age, there's that gender bias of this is how boys are, this is how girls are. Is that the reason why women, there's more discussion around the topic for women. So women in society talk openly about their emotions and this, and boys or men don't, even though society is now trying to push it, the condition for so long and so intensely. Like when I was young, you didn't do it. Get up, you're fine. You know, and I think there's a certain level of that you got to do with every child. It's about making them resilient. But discussing emotions is such a big topic now in schools and society. So where in society do we need to look at maybe improving those gender biases? Well, how would we start doing that? I suppose that's my question, because that is a really deep topic, because it's something that you can control on an independent level. But what do we need to do holistically to actually start moving forward, not just looking at childlessness, but as society, for men to start feeling comfortable and not feeling abnormal to talk about their feelings?
Yeah. It starts with education. It starts with changing stuff. And the stuff you guys are doing makes a difference. People will come on here, see you and say, actually, Kieran and Sean, they said that. I can say that. And it's a great thing that other men can and counsellors can point to your podcast and say, go and check that out. Just have a bit of a listen. Because that's what men tend to like to do, a little bit of research, but on their own. So pointing things out to them. So I always say it's a bit like very typical of men and women shopping. You know, men, right, I'm going to go to the hardware store, I'm going to get this, this, and this, and then I'm out. Rather than going around grazing, going backwards and forwards between shops and comparing stuff. That might be quite an age, not appropriate metaphor, really, because everybody's online. But I guess people do the same sort of thing online as well.
Women like to kind of almost sometimes reverberate around their feelings, whereas and explore them. Men want to identify problem, solve problem, move forward.
Yeah. I think there's something around there about just accepting that sometimes you can't solve a problem.
Mm.
So when I was doing some counselling, I was counselling a couple, and they were having an issue. They were actually going through infertility treatment. And a very common thing, I'm sure you would have heard it and maybe experienced it, is she was saying, he never says anything. I'm in bits. I'm all the place. And he never says anything. So I tried to say, what's happening is that concrete block, it's like a volcano in there. He's aware of the volcano. And if he lifts that concrete block, it's all going to come flooding out and it'll kill you. And he doesn't have the little tunnels going sideways to diffuse all that energy that's built up. And so that's why he's saying nothing. The other thing is, he's conditioned to go out and do stuff. Sat on the sofa, listening to you remote, and he can't do anything about it. Desperately wants to do it. If he could reach inside, get that emotional block and take it away and do something, he would love to do it. But he hasn't got the skills, not through any fault of his own, because that's the way he is. And we ended up doing a bit of a role reversal where I was her and she was him. And afterwards she went, I get it. I get it now, sort of thing. So we just have to work it out. And part of that was just giving him time to process as well. So give him time to go to the shed and just do something. So for him, it was like, go and do something that you know you can do. Take something apart, build something up. But in the background, while you're doing something you know, inside, there's a lot of processing coming on. 2 or 3 days later, he might well come round halfway through tea and say, by the way, what we were talking about 3 days ago, I think this is it. Now I see, or whatever.
Do you know, that's exactly obviously now I go to the gym for different reasons, but that's why I went to the gym. Like when we were obviously for health reasons as well, but I found it like a massive mental health healer, processor. I used to also just go out to the garage and like mess around with my motorbike. I'd take bits off of it, clean it, just kind of things that I didn't really have to do, but I had to be busy. Is there an element of that that is like male genetics as well? Or is it the fact of we are unconsciously conditioned in society? Because I would have thought we are kind of programmed in some way genetically to kind of maybe be protectors and things like that. Or is that just thousands of years of gender biased?
I think the thing with genetics is all geneticists would say, well, genetics has an effect, but it's probably not the real determining effect of it. It's an effect, but another thing about genetics is we sort of used to think they were fixed. Genetics were your genetics and that was it. More and more there's the epigenetics of actually, everyday things influence your genetics in little bits way, and sometimes they have an effect. A lot of the time, they don't. But when we're talking about that, the vulnerability of men to their environment, how it influences their sperm, again, has been played down or not been appreciated enough. It's coming through now. But I think that's going to be quite a big thing when it comes to genetics. And I know in your chat with Tracy Sainsbury. Yeah. She was talking around those sort of things, wasn't she, around sperm. And there's a lot of things around, you know, eating well, exercise, not drinking, not smoking, all that sort of thing. And there's certainly some research where the embryologist was looking at sperm and saying, I know this person's been smoking just before this sample was given. So I could see the effects on it. So genetics, well, none of us are geneticists. And if any geneticists are listening, they're probably going, oh no. it's a developing field. It's a really big field. So it can have some effect. How much effect is... But I would certainly, coming from my background, would go society has a lot to go on. So there's a researcher called Marcia Inhorn, I think at Harvard or Yale or one of those big unis. She's done a lot of work in the Middle East with Muslim men going through infertility treatment. And one of the things she says is what's not really appreciated about, because certainly in the West, there's quite a negative view of Muslim men, and particularly in that area, is how much family life means to those men. And how much that's really appreciated, really celebrated, that the men celebrate being in the family, celebrate being fathers, and how that's reinforced structurally within society. And there is some celebration of fatherhood. Structurally, I'm not quite sure. It's certainly not the same level, I don't think.
You touched upon earlier kind of societally, over like with us, and I again, there was something I resonated with, was that gap seemed to extend, is when we kind of got through the wedding season and then we were going into the child season, and my friends were all doing it, and I'm looking so near but so far, and I'm seeing, like, for example, baby names that my wife and I had talked about and really liked being used by close friends that you couldn't then use, and that gap was extending, and I felt excluded from conversations. So are there any other kind of societal impacts on being childless or child-free, childless not by choice, whatever people want to term it? And are there different perceptions for men in that situation than compared to women?
I think definitely so. So I said before there was a wider range of narratives around women. One of those is for childless women, They can be called selfish. You know, you're a career so and so, and you don't care. You're not doing your duty. To real empathy and sympathy that you've not become a mother. You look at men; it's not the same. It's not the same. Quite often, it's you can go and sow your wild seeds then, and that may be appropriate when you're in your late teens, early 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, me in my 60s, going around sowing my wild seeds, working class lad from Manchester. It's the only seed is going to be CD, really, from that. Isn't it? Well, see what I did there? I put a Y on. Making this up as I go along. So for men, it's sort of dismissed. It's like they don't want to know about it too much. And also, actually, for older men, you get that. But also, there's something about older men and being perverts around that area. It's definitely something around paedophilia. So one of my colleagues from a former life, when I started doing this sort of research, she said, it's really funny. My dad came for Sunday lunch and he was about an hour late. I said, why are you late? I played some football with some lads in the park. She went, you can't do that. You can't do that because people think you're a pervert. And that's sort of how embedded it is. And how separate it is. So the difference there between men and women is structural.
Yeah,
but also how we're educated as well to be, it comes in with that.
You can see how that would unfold, how people would think that, when actually it's just a guy wanting to play a bit of football and wants to interact with younger people, and it's... you can see how society can rubber stamp quite easily. It comes back to that society stigma again, though, doesn't it? It's like we go round in a circle. We always come back, and it's the barrier that stops men really engaging with society as they wish to.
Yeah. Yeah, another way that sort of happens in society is birth registration. Mother's fertility history is taken, father's isn't. And that makes a big difference, actually, when it comes to stats. So you've probably heard recently the fertility rate in the country has gone down to below 2.1 to 1.8 or whatever. But that's not really the fertility rate. It's the women's fertility rate, not the men's, because we don't have that data. So for decades, that has happened, that the woman's fertility history is taken at birth registration, which means we know very accurately how many childless women there are in the UK, and actually in most of the world as well. In the UK, it's about 19%, and that's been rising. So in about 1970, it was about 10%. So that's been increasing over the years and increasing. But for men, we don't have that big tranche of data because we don't take that that information at birth registration. And that's really important because that data is used for predicting how many people are going to be going into hospitals, what facilities are you going to need for old people for care, health and social care. And so a lot of that data is based on 50% of the population. And there's probably more childless men than there are childless women. You know this because they do sort of spot studies every now and then rather than this constant collection. And all the way around the world, it's higher rate for childless men. In this country, it's about 25%. And that's biologically childless. The only countries that do take it are in the Nordic countries. Because of their equality laws when they set it up. So we're in the 70s, if you're doing this for women, we must do it for men. And so that's why they record it. And so that's why their structures and laws are for men and women. So you may have just seen in the news comparing Sweden has changed its paternity laws slightly, so that men and fathers and mothers had the same paternity, and now they can do a deal, so one can take the other one's sort of thing. And one of the biggest things that could happen in this country is if we up the paternity leave.
Mm.
One of the best things for fathers and for children would be that early stage paternity bonding.
Yeah, and not to mention the gender pay gap, because quite often that what sets that back is women having that career
factor.
Gap.
Yeah.
And that helps the equality for all. But yeah, that early bonding with children, I was really kind of hurt to have to go back to work after. It would have been a week, but I got cobbled together some spare leave because of where that it fell within my annual leave year to do it. And yeah, I wanted to be there. I wanted to be like in the trenches, changing that horrendous nappies, etc. But it's I think. But then, thankfully, it seems that the narrative is changing around that, the kind of shared parenthood. Elliot Ray is a fantastic chap who is raising a lot of awareness around that. And he has this Parenting Out Loud campaign about kind of equal parental rights. And thankfully, there are a few really kind of forward-thinking companies that are adopting this now, which is really good to know.
Absolutely. I've done some research study with the OU, and we were looking at father's influence on breastfeeding. And part of the studies on that were that how fathers were excluded in the time before birth, in that training area when you go to the classes and stuff. Obviously I'm so into it I can't remember the technical name for that, so I'll keep it simple for me. And one of the guys said, well, you know, when it came to breastfeeding, we were told to go off down the pub. And yet the partner is such an influence in helping breastfeed and feeding anyway, and it can be really important for the relationship, for the mother's bond with the child, but also for the father's bond for the child, and also for the family.
When my son was born, my wife was she had just started training to be a health visitor, but she was a midwife before, and we had lots of discussions about the importance of the presence of the father right at the beginning. And I should echo what Sean said. I remember that feeling of I've got to go back to work. But then there was that empty part of me that was like, well, this is what I'm meant to do. You know, going back to what the stereotype says a man's got to do. And I'm not saying that at some point I didn't have to go back to work, because I did. I've got to pay for my family. But at the same time, I wanted that time at home. I think I had a similar time to Sean, where it would have been maybe a couple of weeks. But
yeah,
I was lucky enough as well that Seb came just before the Easter holidays, so I ended up having a month. But even then, it was like, I've still got to go back. It was tough. It was tough. But once again, as I said, it shows the society norms and how it needs to change.
And a lot of men say, I don't want to be like my dad, who was forced back to work, and I didn't have any contact with him until whatever. So a lot of men now, I want to have that time. I want to build these bonds up. I want to know how to do this. And there is information around that I think that's a generational shift as well. And also talking generations, like now I'm 64. Like I say, in my mid-30s, my peers were becoming parents. Well, now they're becoming grandparents. So there's a time when they're just kids, and then the kids shoot off and we all come back together again. And then they become grandparents. And then they go away doing lots of grandparents stuff. And grandparents are very important when it comes to liberating parents so they can work and do all that sort of malarkey.
Well, that's something that I was definitely going to ask you about, is because it's digging up all that pain again, and all those feelings that you would have experienced 30 years ago suddenly gets brought back up because of that. It's the realization that, oh, I'm never going to be a biological grandfather. So how does that show up for you?
You know, it's like that thing in I don't know if you've seen this shot of a guy on a train. He's in an empty carriage and he looks across and there's another train and there's a party happening in there. And it's a bit like that. And actually, I should be on that train, but I can't get there. And I took this journey that I didn't realize wouldn't get me there. So there's a sort of not being able to be virile through choice sort of thing. And it's even now, so it comes at different times. Like you were saying, that the flame goes in and out.
The pilot light,
it's exactly the same now. It's a bit different for me now because I've done the research. I know why I'm feeling. I know I'm not alone, which is a big thing to say. Actually, you're not alone, and that you struggle to express yourself verbally and not through actions, not your fault. It's very common, and you can change it with a little bit of help. But I think that, you know, hearing somebody else's story, making your own story from it, I know that other people have experienced what you're going through is really in point. So I sort of know that. But there's still a sadness there. And it's like a constant sadness sometimes, but sometimes it's really big and sometimes it's not. And so Christmas is a terrible... I hate Christmas because it's so focused on kids and it's the life I could have had but don't have. And I think as you get older, there's all those milestones, the missed milestones, really, you're aware. Like, I know, taking your kid to primary school or nursery, or when they say their first word, and later on when they're going to school, when they're going to university, when they have their first relationships, when the relationships break down, you have to be there, all that sort of thing. So obviously I'm aware of it because I can say it. I'm aware of what I'm missing.
Do you have any, there'll be people listening, and I acutely remember Christmases as well, coming around all too quickly again without a child in arms, and there'll be people who are in that now. Do you have any kind of hints or tips of how to manage that and other things like Father's Day, for example?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can avoid it. You can just stay locked in and block yourself out. You can... sort of do a list of what's important to you and do those things. So what I do is do the stuff that I've been putting off. So Christmas, a great time to do tax returns if you're doing tax, because the website's not going to be charged up. You can get your tax returns in. You can do any sort of that admin stuff. So I'm surrounded by... shit, really. Because I just thought, oh, that's really interesting. I put it there. And there's piles of stuff I'm really interested in that I then forget to read. So I'll come in here and talk, well, you know what? I'll have a tidy. And that's that great thing of doing something. So I can background process then and just let those things. I write a little bit of poetry every now and then if I'm feeling something really intense. Actually, I need, rather than holding on to this, it's better to get it out. So you're really lucky I don't publish it, because it'd be just too good. People would cry, not for a good reason. So yeah, it's just doing what you can and making it your own. So sort of seize the day and own the day.
We want to tell you about Impril, the unique supplement for conception, which is recommended by fertility specialists for both men and women. We know that good nutrition is really important for fertility, but we are also aware that it's practically impossible to maintain a diet that is perfectly balanced, especially for conception. Choosing the right supplement can be confusing. Many multivitamins contain strong antioxidants, which can actually damage sperm quality. Imprill is made from activated micronutrients that help every cell within the human body, from the biggest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These micronutrients have been clinically proven to significantly improve live birth rates for men and women who have previously been struggling to get pregnant. You can find out more and hear from couples who have used Imprill by visiting fertilityfamily.co.uk. If you decide this is for you, there's a 10% discount just for our listeners. So make a note of the code MF10. That's MF10.
I think that's amazing advice. I think keeping yourself busy during difficult times, even though it is difficult, it helps you cope with things. That really does. It goes back to the fact of going to the gym or fixing my motorbike, those type of things. You're just doing something and it helps you process it, doesn't it? Or ignore it completely, because you can kind of just completely block it out. And that works for some people.
Yeah. If you're into games or whatever,
buy the newest one and sit and play the newest game, because they're about 5 years long these days. They just keep going on.
Another level.
I don't get a chance now. I don't even finish them. So,
and there's that saying, you know, this too will pass.
Mm.
And there's something around that.
Yeah.
I'm in a bad place now, but it will pass.
I distinctly remember, especially before we had success with our treatments, this real need to be a dad, the broodiness like you've spoken about, but it was like really deep.
Yeah.
It was almost like I felt it was my purpose, like I needed to do it. Now, there may be guys listening to this that for them having children isn't an option, whether maybe they decide to not take an alternative route to parenthood or find themselves in a similar situation as you have, where it's just occurred through life. How can they still feel like they've got purpose to their life? And how could they feel like they're still a man, even though they haven't fulfilled what really deep inside them is something they want to? Because that was really one of my worries. Like, if I don't have children, am I even a man? I remember thinking that, you know, and the processing that came along with that. So what advice would you give to someone, a guy who sat there, you know, facing this situation, who really doesn't know what steps to take next? How can he give himself purpose to continue?
A really good question, a really deep question, and it's an existential question, and that's maybe something goes about society, how we defined through our virility existentially. For women, it's inside, it's through their internal virility, and for men, it's the external virility. So like sperm can exist outside the body for a couple of hours. It's one of the few cells that can. So we have to be a bit like this sperm and exist outside. So there's other ways of being virile and of validating yourself. And you can look and say, there's a great song by Paul Simon. There's lots of great songs by Paul Simon. But this one says, you know, I can't run, but I can walk much faster. And I think there's that thing. I can't do this, but I can do that. And it's finding I can do that and I want to do that. It could be part of that is living with sadness, living with bereavement. And you guys have said this, that actually I wouldn't be the person I am if I hadn't gone through what I'd gone through. So there's something around of, okay, at the moment it's terrible and you can't see how it's going to end. Well, instead of it being black, turn the C to an N and make it blank. Make it blank, then you can put something in there and you can choose what you put in there. And it doesn't have to be all things all at once. tiny little steps get you there. And sometimes you might have to take a step back or a step to the side, a bit like England playing, you know, side, side, back, back, side, side. And then, but then, sorry about the football reference, but you move and you create your space, your inner space, as well as your outer space.
Yeah. I found, I think that's amazing advice, right? Because I found that my purpose isn't just one thing. Like, I have multiple purposes in this world, but everything comes at one particular time, if that makes sense. And you go through certain phases in life. Like, there was a phase of my life when all my purpose was to be a father, you know, and I was very fortunate to get through the difficult times, and it happened for me. But I think purpose is something that is a real deep conversation with yourself.
Do you know how I tell you, it might sound completely crazy, but hey, it might help someone. This is kind of how this purpose thing came up for me as well, is when I was really struggling with my identity as a man. If it was the whole thing, if I can't procreate, then what does that make me? I started looking and like researching and looking up great men of history and looking as to what it was, like their main achievement. And at the point they did that, did they already have children? And for example, two names, and this is why it might sound crazy. I'm not in any way comparing myself to these people, but it's as a man, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, both had children and then went on to do the great things they did. They didn't have children and just stop, go, that's my purpose as a man done. So it was that kind of thing. It was like, to keep rolling with the seed analogy, a different type. But that was sowing the seed for me that actually that there's a lot more to me as a man, for the world, for society, or even on a micro level, for my family, for my household, than my ability to procreate.
And just as you're saying that, you know, it's like the family was a stepping stone.
Mm.
But there's other stepping stones. You might just have to find it and place it in there for you to go wherever, upwards, sidewards, whatever. Yeah. And I really feel that I had exactly that thing about wanting to be a dad, and that was consuming for me. And it did consume me, actually. And part of that consumption, quite a lot of it was internal, because I couldn't express it. You know, you can't go down a pub and say, you know, I really want to be a dad. Well, I couldn't anyway at that time in my 30s, and not expect to have the piss taken out of me completely. Part of that would be because we're not raised to deal with that sort of, really, as men with other men, to do that sort of supportive sort of thing. We support each other through actions, you know, men's in sheds, shoulder to shoulder. We do things shoulder to shoulder as equals, and we get through it like that way. My counseling training really helped. That thing about, actually, for me, listening is doing something. I think that's a thing for men. Listening is doing something. You don't have, listening is really a very, very subtle and excellent activity. It's as good as going off and buying some bacon and bringing it back, or bringing back a bonus. Listening, really listening, is so good for your relationship and so good for you. Listening to understand. And it's easily, you can find lots of stuff on the internet on just how to listen, how to do active listening.
Yeah,
active listening's, I think men find that really hard to do. But I remember reading about it for the first time. And it's simple, but there's certain things that you should do. Because I think we're all guilty at sometimes. I am especially, and hopefully my wife won't listen to this one. But sometimes I do have this habit of just glazing over. But when it comes to emotional discussions now, I think because of what I went through, that active listening is so much more intense and engaged, you know, and that's really important for both the male and the female, when especially when you're going through something like this. Because I know we've talked a lot about obviously the men's side today, but we can't forget that obviously there's the female side of things, and that is you are there together to experience that, and it's important that you actively listen to your wives, your partners as well as a man, because it's really important for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I you've both been through counseling, and you would have picked up active listening either consciously or unconsciously through that, and you emulate your counselors by saying, where does that come from? And when you were saying, you know, that man's there thinking, I want to be a dad, and it's not happening for me, and that's my whole thing in the world. So where's that coming from? Is it actually from you, or is it from society? Is it, you know, that this is really expected of you, and you've got to do it right now? You parents are saying, I want to hear, where's baby steps? You know, I've got this put aside. When I was, when I was a young man like you, young gadabouts, my first wife, you know, she had a bottom drawer, which is, I see you looking blank. Okay, you buy stuff for the baby that's going to come in the future, and you put it in the bottom drawer. And actually, one of the guys I worked with way back when I was starting to do this research, and he was in his 40s, he had three kids. So I still go through Mothercare, which is a shop that used to be around. Whenever I was traveling, and feel the booties. It was just beautiful for me, for when I remember when my children were babies. So, and that's that emotional nurturing thing in men that's denied in society, and we're excluded from quite a lot. And we bring it out, and we include. Yeah. We get included.
That's that's huge, really, isn't it? Feeling included, feeling heard and seen, because, and you know, that's you touched upon earlier, that's exactly why we're here, it's why we're doing this, because we found ourselves on the other side of that, and we know what it feels like. And one thing that is now great to see, certainly in the infertility world, is that there is a community starting. You know, it's like small steps, but we're getting there. But in terms of childlessness, what support is out there for men?
There is some. Certainly, I'd look at BICA, British Infertility Counselling Association. There's certainly male counsellors in there, and I, not only if you're circumstantially childless like me, I'd go there, and to a counsellor like that, because they're trained about childlessness, not just infertility, about disenfranchised grief. So there's counselling. You know, if a counsellor, if it doesn't work for you, find another. There's loads out there. I know it used to be one. So yeah, and find one that you like. That's really important, that you feel going to be listened to. For infertility, if you're going through treatment, there's definitely a specific Facebook group for that. There's a lot more coming through on social medias and support around through clinics and stuff like that, and links to clinics. So there's definitely stuff like that. There was a Rod Gilbert thing that I can't remember the name of that he was promoting.
Himfertility.
Thank you. Yeah, Himfertility. That was one. For people like me, there's the Childless Men's Community, which is on Facebook, which is a closed group. But you may find that actually, although childlessness is your thing for whatever reason, but going to something like Andy's Man Club, Men's Sheds, anything like that, may not be specific, but it gets you out, gets you meeting other men, and men who aren't going to judge you.
Yeah, that's really good advice, because I I experienced this through my experience, but also from other guys that I've talked to, have really highlighted that element of loneliness and that need to belong to a group. Now, if you know something like Andy's Man Club, it's that everyone's there to support each other. You're not going to be judged. You will feel belonged. You know, then there are other things out there available. So that it's really good advice. Find somewhere where you can get that support and feel that belongingness. Because I'm sure all three of us here talking have at some point felt that deep loneliness. Whatever the situation, you've just wanted something or someone to talk to. So that's really, really good advice. Thank you, Robin. I feel like we've discussed so much. We could do another 3-4 hours on this because it's literally we're just opening boxes all over the place. So at some point, we'd love to have you back on, Robin. And I think it'd be really interesting to talk about in a future episode, maybe like the research that you've been involved in and things like that, to go into more detail. And we can see how maybe that's evolving and kind of give guys extra hope that, you know, this support is out there because we've done a great job tonight, but it's one interview, isn't it? We just need to keep going. So thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you. And thank you for letting me take over your show, because I feel like I've done 90% of this. I've just been talking at you. Sorry.
No, it's great.
I'm trying to say.
Makes our job easy. Thank you.
No, Sean just said it. It makes our job easy. And it gives us so much more to think about. And like we said before, I've said before, to have you back on and talk so many more topics. Now, just before we end things, we always ask our guests one question, and that is, what one piece of advice would you give a guy, you know, facing, I guess in this case, childlessness? What bit of advice would you give him?
I'd say, you're not alone, and there's lots of people have gone through what you've gone through. In the population, 25% of men are childless. And so you're one of quite a big group, the biggest majority group by any measure at all. You're part of that. So you're definitely not alone, and that there is help out there for you.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Robin. That's sometimes that's all people need to hear, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, you're not on your own. You're not on your own. If listeners want to contact you, Robin, how should they do that?
If you Google me, you'll find my website. You can get through my website. That'd be fine. Okay. robinhadley.co.uk, he said with a panicked look on his face.
Again, thank you so much. And we really look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.